Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, and supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for the next hour, they're going to be those of San Francisco architect Mr. Richard Gage, AIA. He's an architect who has been working with the architects for 9/11 Truth to determine what really happened on September 11th, 2001. Now, certainly everybody has seen the pictures of the plane crashing into the South Tower. And then, of course, the day after the attack, while we had a picture of a plane crashing into the North Tower. But why did the buildings come down the way they did? Because planes crashed into buildings doesn't mean those buildings are going to come down. And why did Building 7 come down at 5:20, 5:15, 5:20 in the evening when it wasn't hit by any airplane? There are a lot of unanswered questions about what happened that day, the lack of any records at the sanctuary site where the plane was supposedly crashed to the ground, and absolutely no records. And the same thing at the Pentagon, but we're not going to be talking about that. We're going to be talking about the fall of the Twin Towers and the fall of the building number 7 in the evening, which was the thing that really got me sometime later to say, well, I know what I saw, but do I really understand what I saw? Mr. Gage, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Thank you, Stan. It's great to be here with you.
And, of course, Mr. Gage has put together a wonderful DVD, which we actually have seen, watched it, and my wife is really very, very critical of a lot of things. Thought you had one of the greatest DVDs she'd seen, certainly one of the finest DVDs on what happened that day. So we actually are going to be carrying the DVD, but why don't you tell us how you got interested in looking into what really happened that day?
Well, I, along with millions of other Americans, saw those tragic events transpiring on 9/11, and I think I can just safely describe my experience as going into a state of shock. I don't recall analyzing these buildings. As an architect of 20 years, I didn't know what I was looking at, and I think that was true for most of us. None of us had ever seen a steel frame skyscraper being explosively destroyed like that one did at virtually free fall speed, like both of those Twin Towers did. And we heard right away pretty much from the experts within a couple of days that, oh, this was a classic progressive collapse. The jet fuel melted the steel and the building couldn't contain the weight of it, and it just came down. And we pretty much let it go. And until about 2 years ago, when I heard on the radio here, a free speech radio, KPFA's in Berkeley. Now, I'm a Reagan Republican. I've voted Republican forever. And here I am listening to this radio, so I'm a little suspicious, right? But I'm listening to David Ray Griffin talking about an alternate version of events that day, and I couldn't believe my ears. I'd never heard anything about this, not in 4 years had I. He was talking about the 118 firefighters describing sounds of explosions, flashes of light, feeling their bones shake 1,700 feet down below on the street at the onset of the destruction of each of these towers. And this was, we did not know about these 118 firefighters until August.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, our guest this afternoon, or this evening, is Richard Gage, who's an architect up in San Francisco, for that matter, and not too far away from where we live. But tell us a little bit about what these firefighters, because I've never heard this story. Certainly, we'll be interviewing David Ray Griffin tomorrow. He's a very, very respectable individual. He's a retired theologian, my understanding, and he's done some excellent work on this subject. But what's this story about the firefighters?
Oh, it's extraordinary, and it's not just firefighters, but other EMTs. The city's fire commissioner, Thomas Von Essen, ordered in October the oral recordings of 503 of his top people working, those who survived after 9/11, of what their experience was to preserve the record. Well, Mayor Giuliani hid and sequestered these oral recordings from the public, but the New York Court State of Appeals overruled them in a lawsuit by the New York Times, and now we know why. Because over 118 of them describe these incredible explosions. So they say rapping like a belt all the way around, like an explosion, all these pops, pop, 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 and then the building came down. They describe the lateral expulsion of this debris and these columns and wall units being ejected out of the buildings with instant speed, which now physicists have documented at 70 and 100 miles an hour, instant horizontal ejection speeds. Gravitational collapse can't accomplish that. The ends of these beams are dripping with molten metal, as seen by the first responders, and pulled out by the iron workers from the catacombs below. The backhoes are picking up debris full of molten metal down at the bottom of all both Twin Towers and this third skyscraper, building number 7, which many of us have not even heard about whatsoever. This was a 47-story skyscraper not hit by an airplane, about a football field away from the Twin Towers. This building, at about 5:20 in the afternoon on 9/11, after an initial penthouse, east penthouse collapse, about 10 seconds later, the global collapse ensues. At virtually free fall speed, the entire building drops almost into its own footprint, almost at free fall speed in 6.5 seconds. Now, against 40,000 tons of structural steel designed to resist that load, you know, for the life of that building.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Sydney, our guest this evening, Richard Gage, talking about what really had intrigued him about what had happened. And, of course, as the building began to collapse, why, you saw these massive steel beams being ejected transversely out of the building as it's collapsing. Certainly, if this was simply a pancaking effect, you wouldn't have been able to eject these massive steel beams. He talks certainly about the fact that the firemen had described, 118 firemen or more, had actually recorded what they heard, and Mayor Giuliani sealed it. He did not want anybody to know what the firemen said they heard or witnessed that day. And only after a lawsuit, which most Americans have never heard of, was that information brought out, and they were describing what sounded like explosions. This started before the buildings began to collapse. And then, of course, Mr. Gage is talking about the molten metal, that you don't get molten metal, certainly from a fire in a steel building. No steel building has ever come down the way that those steel buildings came down. And then he mentioned Building 7, and I'm going to let you go ahead and pick the story up there, Richard.
Oh, yeah. Building 7 is perhaps the smoking gun of 9/11 because it was not hit by an airplane, and yet here it suffers this catastrophic collapse in the exact manner of a classic controlled demolition, in which, in order to facilitate a virtual free-fall collapse of the building, you have to remove most of the key core columns within a tenth of a second of each other, ideally. And then, within a half a second after that, some of the perimeter columns, at least the ones on the bottom, to begin this free-fall collapse that we have, in the first 2 seconds of the building's collapse. It is indistinguishable from free fall. And we have at the bottom of this building all of this molten material. Remember, there's no jet fuel associated with Building 7, and even jet fuel is just a normal hydrocarbon. It doesn't burn hotter than 1,400 degrees. But steel doesn't even begin to melt until about 2,700 degrees, more than twice the temperature that the hottest office fires have ever gotten in high-rises. And by the way, none of those high-rise fires have ever collapsed a high-rise building. Not one. And we have a hundred examples or so of very hot, very large, and very long-lasting fires. So where did all of this molten metal come from? Where we have dozens of quotes from the first responders about this. We have photographs of it. And it doesn't have a source that is explainable within the official story put out by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, or FEMA before them, or in the 9/11 Commission report, which, by the way, doesn't even mention in any one of its 571 pages a mention about World Trade Center 7, the third worst structural failure in modern history. Not one mention. And so we look in the dust for some clue as to what created this molten metal, and we find tiny iron-rich microspheres in all of this powder that blanketed Manhattan from the Twin Towers and the Building 7 collapse. And they are smaller than a human hair, almost perfectly round. There's billions of them. By weight, it's estimated that there's easily a total of about 10 tons throughout all the dust. And these can only, they're molten iron. It's not melted steel. And it has in it the elements, manganese, potassium, aluminum, and iron, and many of them sulfur. These are the classic chemical signature elements of thermite, an incendiary used to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. And guess what the byproduct of thermite is? It is indeed molten iron. So all of the evidence ties together for the classic controlled demolition, but with an unusual key component, not high-energy explosives as in normal controlled demolitions, but this incendiary thermite. It's a case closed, basically. In fact, Dr. Stephen Jones has found the chemical evidence of thermite in the previously molten chunks of previously molten metal. The same chemicals that he finds in these iron-rich microspheres, which, by the way, he's not the only one who finds these. The EPA had the USGS do toxicological studies on this dust. They find and document very well these iron-rich microspheres, which can only be produced in an explosive molten iron event, such as an aluminothermic reaction from thermite, for instance. And they document it on top of the Deutsche Bank building as well. R.J. Lee documents these iron-rich microspheres. They're across the street in the samples Dr. Jones found in the apartment across the street from the Trade Center, and they're on the Brooklyn Bridge 20 minutes later as this dust carries all of these billions of tiny, tiny iron-rich microspheres. This is the smoking gun, but it gets even more interesting. Every one of the dust samples that Dr. Jones found, he found in them also tiny chips of unexploded thermite. These are red on one side, gray on the other. The largest chip he found is about a 16th of an inch long, and the red side is composed of extremely finely ground, nano-sized particles of aluminum and iron oxide, intermixed in an incredibly homogeneous fashion. And this stuff is very high tech. Normal thermite you can buy on eBay. This stuff is actually come out only recently in papers by Los Alamos and Lawrence Livermore Labs. It's a high tech explosive military grade stuff. So this is not made in a cave in Afghanistan. All of a sudden, we're not talking about Al Qaeda anymore as the prime suspect. We don't know who we're talking about. All we're doing at Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth is looking at the forensic, science-based evidence. We're not conspiracy theorists. We're technical building professionals pointing out this specific evidence. We'll let the chips fall where they may in a real investigation, which we're demanding. That is 403 right now, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, signing our petition online at ae911truth.org. And we're asking all of your listeners to sign as well. We have over 1,500 others in addition to the architects and engineers. So please consider signing if you are disturbed by the information you're hearing tonight.
And, of course, if you see the DVD which Richard Gates has produced, you'll certainly be very impressed by it. Now, of course, you point out that there are 47 vertical steel piers that they holding up the building, as well as the peripheral steel structure that makes the building stand. But I know, how would they be able to, would they have to actually cut the supports at one level, at every level, or would they do this at every third or fourth or fifth level? How would they, if indeed this is what happened, and they use thermite to cut those and coordinate them, how many levels would they have to cut them, and would they have to destroy the base of the building to get it to fall the way that it did at the speed of gravity? Because if it come down just pancaked, why, there would have been resistance.
Yes, there certainly would have been resistance. That resistance had to have been removed. And Dr. Gordon Ross has shown in his very interesting video how it appears that the columns were busted with side concussive explosives because the ends of many of the core columns, the welds appear to be busted as opposed to cut with thermite. The beams appear to be more cut with thermite. And then it would be, the columns were 37 and a half feet long, which is three stories, each story being 12 and a half feet long, floor to floor height. And so he suggests that the core columns were taken out in that manner, and of course the girders and columns, which are 30 and 36 inches deep in the core, this is a structure within the structure. This whole structure should have been left standing in any pancaking collapse, as we're told initially by FEMA. This was a pancaking collapse where these trusses, which spanned from the core structure out to the perimeter structure, this is a tube type building, and which allowed for 60 feet of open office planning on each side. And these trusses are blamed for bending because of their more vulnerable posture to the heat that's produced. And then they were told that they pulled away from the perimeter columns, and then they just all pancaked down. NIST came and turned around that theory and blamed the persistence of the connection of those horizontal trusses underneath the floors, those connections to the perimeter. Thus, that when they say they bowed down, they pulled in the column. Well, either way, none of it makes sense because there's no evidence in the NIST report to suggest that there was hot enough fires to soften any steel. They show 400 to 500 to 600 degree fires at max. But anyway, be that as it may, their entire report stops right at the point with initiation of collapse.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Go right ahead. You said the report stops when you get to the initiation of the collapse, so go right ahead.
And this that's remarkable because structural engineers analyze the resistance capability of a building to the upper part of the building every day. This is what they do. This is not rocket science. NIST could not afford to carry their analysis beyond the initiation of collapse because they could not show that the building would have collapsed. In fact, there is analysis on our website in the technical articles section that shows very clearly that the impact, even with an impact load, that the lower portion of the building, this cold, intact 80,000 tons of structural steel, would immediately have resisted that load from the 15-story section above the airplane impact in the case of the North Tower. So, but what's more interesting even still is that all of the videos and the photos show very clearly that what's happening in the North Tower is that that 15-story mass is destroying itself in the first 2 seconds. Half of it is gone. It's telescoped down upon itself before any downward movement from the point of impact.
How could that 15-story put telescope on itself? That doesn't make sense.
Well, it could only have been that could only have happened if the columns were being removed and the supporting lateral structure of the girders were being cut as well. And this is what you see. The whole thing is destroyed in 4 seconds. There is no pile driver after 4 seconds pushing this building down. What we see is that it is tearing itself apart at virtually free fall speed. We have asymmetrical damage with the airplane hitting one side of the building, and yet from all the videos below, there's this symmetrical progression, like a belt, as the first responders described it, of these explosions, numerous explosions, sending debris out 70, 100 miles an hour, 500 feet, 600 feet laterally. It's proceeding down the building uniformly all the way around the building despite the asymmetrical damage, despite the fact that there's no pile driver up there pushing it down. And what's happening to those 110 floors? They are an acre in size each. We would expect to see some of them down at the bottom in what amounts to a pancake theory. I'd be looking for some pancakes. I'd settle for half the floors, 50. No, I'd settle for 20. There's not even one floor found at the base of either the North Tower or the South Tower. They have all been systematically pulverized, the concrete, 90,000 tons of it, to a small fragment size of powder, small like talcum powder, most of it. People were picking it up, and it's not even granular. It's powdery. And there was some gravel, too, but this is most of it. And the floor trusses and the metal decking, 22-gauge metal decking against which all this concrete was poured initially, it's all been fragmented to basically what is found as metal filings inside all of the samples of dust. There's no metal decking, no floor trusses, and no macroscopic chunks of concrete.
Hold that thought, please, right there. Well, certainly Richard was saying that if this had been a pancake affair, as we've been told, that some of the floors would have been intact. I mean, they wouldn't have all been pulverized, but there were no big chunks of concrete. Everything was simply vaporized. In fact, there are 1,100 bodies that have never been found. Now, ordinarily, if a pancake had actually occurred, you'd expect that the bodies would have been crushed, but the body parts of the bodies would have been there. They would have been horribly disfigured and flattened out, but there weren't any. These bodies disappeared exactly as did the concrete. The concrete was simply vaporized. How, in a pancake situation, where one floor is falling on the other, could you vaporize the concrete? Would that be a fair appraisal?
It could only have been done with some very high-tech explosives. as a matter of fact. And those that's coincident with the sounds of these explosions heard and the flashes of light seen by these 118 first responders.
You know, we've never heard of that story about the first responders, the 118 of them, and that somebody wanted to seal their testimony so that the American people would never know. How would they could seal that so that the average listener out there who's hearing you tonight probably has never heard of that?
Well, fortunately, the New York Court State of Appeals saw it the same way you did, overturned the city who was trying to conceal this information, and now we have the transcripts on the website of the New York Times. You can see this article. It's very interesting. I don't have the exact name, but 118 first responders. If you go to our website, ae911truth.org, you can pull up this article. It's fascinating, because they describe in very graphic detail their experience of these explosions. And they're not just, you know, confusing floors crashing down, because many of these people are 1,700 feet below, you know, on the street, triangulated. It's a 1,368-foot high building, but triangulated. They're far away, and then all these explosions start at the onset of destruction of these two buildings. People are ducking. They're hearing incredible explosions at the onset, way down below. Now, we would expect these bodies, as you mentioned, to be contained between these pancaking floors, but that's not what happens. They found just in August, in 2007, they found 700 tiny bone fragments, a half an inch long, on top of the neighboring skyscrapers. Now, what were they doing so small, and how did they get on top of the skyscraper across the street? The plane flew over that skyscraper to hit the South Tower. And so there's no rational explanation whatsoever for all of those bone fragments appearing over there. But the evidence does tie in with everything else we've been talking about, the complete disappearance of these floor panels, the concrete. There's no filing cabinet. There was tens of thousands of dense steel filing cabinets. There's not one found at the base of the Twin Towers. No desks, no chairs, no computers, and no filing cabinets. That is bizarre. All we find is these tiny metal pieces, like metal filings in all the dust.
And, Chris, I would once again stress the fact that 1,100 bodies have never been found. There's a wonderful book I just been reading.
Well, wait, let me correct you. There were 300 whole bodies found.
Right.
There was 1,100 that were completely vaporized.
Right.
But they found 6,000 pieces of bodies that were small enough to fit into a test tube. So that's not the 1,100 you're describing. That's really important. There was not even a piece small enough to get any DNA evidence for 1,151 bodies.
And that really, to me, is a leading fact. That and the fact that apparently that fire burned down to the base of the building, according to this book written by the local medical examiner who examined the DNA that was sent to him for 3 months down in the basement there, below the World Trade Center, at an intensity of heat equal to that of a crematorium for 3 months. How could that possibly be?
Yeah, and there was tons of molten metal, several tons. They said the first responders flowing like lava, they said. And this has never happened in any fire that firemen have seen. It's not a part of this because the office fires don't get hot enough to melt steel or to produce this molten iron, which, of course, as we mentioned, is the byproduct of the thermite reaction.
Will you hold on to that thought? We're going to be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Mr. Richard Gage, who is a San Francisco architect, and is, of course, telling us what he has discovered and what a number of other architects who are working with him have discovered as they begin to analyze what happened. Now, of course, we've had a number of government finance and government-sponsored and government-controlled investigations, and certainly there was one rather extensive one put out by people who were supposedly experts, but wasn't it that they sort of explained what happened to the Twin Towers, but they sort of ignored what happened to Building Number 7? What was the background of that rather extensive investigation?
Well, FEMA did look at Building 7, and their conclusion was that their best hypothesis, they said, which is fire damage, 8 randomly scattered fires in this high-rise, plus random damage from the collapsing of World Trade Center North Tower, their best hypothesis, which is that, has only a low probability of occurrence. That's their best hypothesis, that this building came virtually at free fall speed, virtually into its own footprint, virtually in the same manner as a controlled demolition. They're saying, our best hypothesis is that it came down by fire, but we have no confidence in that hypothesis. So what do? They punt. You know, they basically say, well, they do say that further research investigation is necessary in order to resolve this issue. But unfortunately, by the time their report came out in May of 2002, they, FEMA, had ordered the systematic scrubbing of the site to where 99.9% of all of the steel of Building 7 and most all of the steel of the World Trade Center North and South Towers was sent to China for recycling.
You would think that they would
so that it couldn't be analyzed. I mean, normally, when you have a collapsing building of steel, everything is laid out, analyzed, categorized, and there's a huge investigation. This was, all the evidence was scrubbed, sent to China before the report came out.
So that there really could be no independent investigation of what happened. Everything was done so hurriedly, it was almost as if they were afraid that somebody might question what we were told.
It sure appears that way. And of course, there's plenty of evidence to suggest that these buildings were brought down by thermite, as we've gone over today.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Mr. Richard Gage, a San Francisco architect and accredited architect. And this is his profession. He builds big buildings with steel-reinforced buildings, and he understands that, as do a number of the other architects who are working with him in architects and engineers for 911 Truth. Why don't we, of course, get your website out so people would know how they can get to your website and get the information that you make available, and then we'll talk a little bit about your DVD, which we do carry. What's the title of that DVD again?
Blueprint for Truth.
Blueprint for Truth.
Excuse me, 9/11 Blueprint for Truth.
All right.
The Architecture of Destruction.
All
and,
right.
That's available at ae911truth.org, the website where we lay out all of the evidence that has impressed the hundreds of architects and engineers that are demanding a real investigation by Congress. In fact, we're not waiting for Congress to do it because we've trusted them once. We're performing our own investigation, and we will make those results available when we have 1,000 architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, which we expect to have on September 11th, 2008. In 3 months, we are on a massive campaign to sign up architects and engineers.
All right, fine. Well, now, certainly, if people go to your website, which is www.ae911truth.org, what will they find there?
Well, on the right side, you'll see the evidence for Building 7 and the Twin Towers. the controlled demolition of these buildings. There's a video right there. You can watch Building 7 come down. It will shock you because it will remind you instantly of the old hotels that you've seen probably on the television in Las Vegas as they bring them down by cutting the steel out from under them. They come right down into their own footprints at virtually free fall speed, just like Building 7 did. A very different type of controlled demolition, a classic controlled demolition, versus what we have in the Twin Towers, where it's this incredibly explosive event, hurling perimeter wall units up to 600 feet away at 70 to 100 miles per hour, where we have squibs or mistimed explosions. Some think they might be timed appropriately, some mistimed, whatever. They're very clearly explosions that occur 20, 40, and even 60 stories down below this collapsing structure up above. These squibs, we're told by NIST, are actually puffs of air being produced by the pile driver up above, which is driving this building down to the ground, they say, and that air's got to go down somewhere, right? It comes down the elevator hoistways and comes out. Well, first of all, these are not puffs of air, they're pulverized building materials. You can see columns and aluminum cladding blown off the building in these things, and they occur at almost 200 feet per second. These are propelled by explosive speeds, and they also occur at very geometric points in the buildings, right the center between the corners of the buildings, in most cases down below. There's a fairly rigid geometry to how they occur. It's not a natural occurrence whatsoever. And if you did have puffs of, if you did have a pile driver pushing air down the hoistways, and it would fill this 60-foot open office planning space fairly uniformly with air before it would bust out several windows, if it busted out any, but not these highly focalized pinpoint ejections that occur at predetermined specific points on the building. So the NIST answer here carries no water whatsoever.
And for our listeners, basically they look like a finger of smoke. It's just shooting out from the building, many times 5, 10, 20, 30 floors below the level of collapse. And you're watching it come down. If you can do it in slow motion, you can actually see these, they call them squibs, but they're actually like a finger of smoke coming out. Would suggest, of course, some sort of an explosive. It's very localized. It's not a general thing at all. And, you know, of course, if there is this pile driver effect, the easiest thing would be to just to drive this right down the elevator shafts and for this to come out of the bottom of the building rather than breaking out windows. So it really is very impressive. Do you have pictures of that on your website of these squibs of smoke coming out?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, plenty of them. In fact, the entire PowerPoint is visible on the left side of the website, and people can watch the DVD online. That's about 2 hours long. If you have only 20 minutes, I recommend people watch the interview that we did on Omni Television in Vancouver on the left side. That's a very, very pointed interview there that where we were able to bring out much of this evidence. Also, there's technical articles down below on the left side. There's fascinating information articles in the middle, including the recent joining of our AE 9/11 Truth team by State Senator Karen Johnson of Arizona, who is encouraging us to speak to her fellow state senators at the end of the month. We're very excited about that. So there's lots to see and read about on this very unique website.
Well, I think the most interesting thing, and the thing that finally convinced me that it really wasn't true, and this was a couple of years after the attack, was watching the video of Building 7 come down. And the first thing you see is the center of the building collapse. You see just sort of this indentation. There's a little penthouse there, and suddenly that falls into the building. And then after, and I assume this reflects taking out the central core of the building, central core of support, and then the base of the building collapses, just disintegrates, and the building comes down, just like those buildings we've seen so often in pictures of in Las Vegas and elsewhere. So, I mean, there's no way that, to me, that it would be logical that, first of all, the central core would go, and then the base would go just simultaneously, or a moment or two afterwards, and then that building would fall at the speed of gravity.
Yeah, there's no other explanation. A building cannot fall at the speed of gravity almost. I mean, 6 seconds versus speed of gravity versus 6.5 seconds. It's in fact, in the first 2 seconds, it is indistinguishable from the speed of gravity. And then it slows down a tiny bit. But without having first removed the 40,000 tons of structural steel, I mean cut, when I say remove. This building collapsed into a pile about 4 stories high. It was a 47-story skyscraper. All of those joints, or most all of them, had to have been cut in order to facilitate such a clean laying down, a house of cards. There were moment-resisting frames in this building, where the columns and the beams were welded together very, very rigidly. They would not just fold and collapse. They were designed to take the lateral loads imposed by hurricane force winds in New York of 140 miles an hour. This building would not have just given up the ghost. Every joint, basically, giving up its strength in order to facilitate no resistance to a virtually a free fall collapse.
Well, I was told by a gentleman I was talking to the other day that this building was built differently than any other building had ever been built, and that's why it came down. Is that really true? Is there anything unique about the
construction? Oh, yeah, there, it sure is. And let's talk about that. There was an existing building when this building was designed. It had had to span over an existing electrical substation. So there were massive trusses over the top of this substation, unusual for a high-rise to be built over an existing building, and it had transfer trusses and large columns. But NIST, in its December 18th meeting, which we attended via telecon, claimed that there's suspicious of a column near the 9th through the 13th floor, column number 79, under the east penthouse, because the east penthouse collapses about 10 seconds prior to the global collapse. And so they blame this on a fire, a normal office fire, by the way, not diesel fuel-fed fires, and not by damage, because this is back in the northeastern section of the building where there was no damage by the Trade Center North Tower during its collapse, and no diesel fires above the fifth floor. The fifth floor is where we have the generators and the diesel fuel. So we're told that this particular column is the culprit, but what happens in an office fire is they move about 20 minutes through the space, and there's not enough time to heat up a column, particularly a column that is fireproofed, and all of this building was fireproofed, and particularly a column that weighed 15,000 pounds per floor. This was a huge, massive column that could not have been heated up by any 20-minute fire. And in fact, NIST actually has to claim that 3 floors would have collapsed in order for this column to buckle. And there's no evidence on the exterior curtain wall that there was any collapse of these three floors surrounding this column at the 9th through the 13th floor.
Well, yeah, there have been, it's been said that the twin towers were really not very economically feasible. In fact, there were some people who'd even wondered about demolishing them and putting up something that would probably work and work more efficiently. Is there any truth to that?
In other words, I'm sorry, I got distracted, Stan. I apologize.
Well, that's all right. Well, I've heard, and I don't know whether it's true or not, but that the Twin Towers certainly were not working out very well financially. They were having trouble getting it all rented out, and there were a lot of maintenance problems with it, and some people had even talked about possibly demolishing those Twin Towers beforehand, but there was just no way that would be allowed by the local building people, that they would be too dangerous to demolish the buildings. Is that true, or is that simply one of these tales that circulates?
Well, it would be extremely dangerous. I've heard, although I don't have evidence to support it, that these buildings, the Port Authority actually applied to the city for a demolition permit to bring the buildings down, because they were not successful financially right off the bat in the first decade. And even recently, there were many floors that were empty. It was a problem. In fact, many people don't even know that the buildings changed hands from the Port Authority, who developed them and owned them, over to Larry Silverstein and others who purchased them in a 99-year lease only 6 weeks prior to 9/11. And in fact, the security company was, of course, changed with the new owners, and we would be looking to that security company for an explanation as to who had access to these buildings to set these charges. And let's explore how they might have had access. With there was 50,000 occupants in these buildings, how might they have had access to set these charges? Well, if you could get into the elevator hoistway, you'd have access to every one of the core columns and beams in that interior structure, because there's an elevator hoistway next to almost all of them. And in fact, there was a modernization the 9 months prior to 9/11 of the elevators, and Ace Elevator had this contract. And so we would expect that company would be asked a lot of very serious questions about their activities during that modernization. There were guards placed at these locked elevator shafts where one in turn was locked down. Nobody would have seen activity and while this work was going on, they wouldn't have known what's going on in there. They certainly heard the workmen. There's white powder people are complaining about white powder throughout the building coming through the ventilation shafts and so forth. And this would be indicative of the access they would have had to make through the elevator hoistways, which was 2 3-quarter-inch layers of gypsum board designed to protect the building from a fire rising up through the elevator hoistway. So if once they got through that gypsum board, they could easily have planted these charges in the columns and beams there. But they would have had to have access through this security company. So who was on that security company, by the way? We would like to see Marvin Bush ask some questions. He's on the board of directors of that company.
But Marvin Bush, the president's brother, was on the board. That's certainly a strange coincidence.
Yeah, we think so, too. So there's clearly some questions under oath in subpoena that is needed in a real investigation of many of these players.
Well, you know, Chris, we really don't know what is known. We do know that the 9/11 commission was appointed, and certainly under the supervision of President Bush, because he refused to allow an independent investigation, but they interviewed 1,200 people, and the testimony of only 100 was used. The other testimony, the other 1,100 people, was sealed for 50 years for privacy purposes, of course. Why would you seal the testimony of 1,100 people? Why not let people read what they said? These were people who were there. They witnessed what happened. It's almost as if they were afraid that well, they claimed that they didn't want Osama bin Laden to find out what these people were talking about or what we knew ahead of time. But I would think that some people might ask, were they more afraid the American people might find out what happened?
Well, yes, and this was the most secretive investigation ever. This was a public building, and NIST had every reason to make their investigation open, transparent, and repeatable, and it was anything but that. Structural engineers were railing against NIST for the black box approach. You can't see what values they used, in many cases, to get their computer models to show that the buildings came down. In fact, they're basically even are quite open about having fudged many of their values in these computer models, because they create these scenarios in which they have realistic scenarios and unrealistic scenarios, C and D, and then realistic ones are A and B. Well, A and B didn't bring the building down. They had to exaggerate all kinds of factors to get them to be what they called unrealistic in order to get the computer models to show the buildings failed.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Okay, we've just got 3 minutes now before we get to the end of the program. So why don't you just go right ahead and carry on that thought or anything else you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, it's clear once people look at the evidence that we have a real problem with the official investigations. Everybody, almost everybody who looks at this evidence with an open mind, comes to these conclusions. I've spoken in 36 cities to thousands of people, and I asked for a show of hands before and after. And in almost every case, the people who don't agree with me in the beginning all agree with me at the end, and there's some people who remain unsured sometimes. So the evidence is clear, and it speaks for itself, and we have to get off our butts and do something about the situation, because let's face it, if we have a controlled demolition in one of these buildings, Building 7, or all three, we have something that is very different than what the official story tells us, what our government has been telling us. We're not talking about Al-Qaeda any longer. Osama bin Laden, it becomes irrelevant, and we're looking at some sort of an operation that could only have been carried out with the complicity of some elements in control here. We don't go any farther than that because we don't know. We're not conspiracy theorists. But your listeners have an obligation to themselves, to their country, and to their children to find out the truth of what happened on 9/11 to these three high-rise collapses. So examine our evidence, sign our petition, and tell everyone you know about AE911Truth.org, and send the link to every architect and every engineer that you can find. Furthermore, support us financially. We can't continue to try to save our country by mortgaging our house. And that's what we've done. We've run out of funds, and I will be relocating my residence to a less expensive residence, as my desire to carry the truth forward exceeds my goals of lifestyle and so forth.
Well, I appreciate it.
So I'm asking your listeners for support there by becoming sustaining members for as little as $10 per month. You can help immeasurably.
Well, we really appreciate everything you do and your courage in taking a stand in this, because it's so vitally important that the truth be brought out, because, of course, this was a watershed event. God bless, and thanks very much, Richard. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much, Stan.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do hope that many of you enjoyed the program. Richard, Mr. Gage is a very courageous individual. He had to actually mortgage his house to get the funds to be able to travel and to put together the DVD and the other things he's done at tremendous expense, and I will tell you at personal risk, because we've talked to people like William Rodriguez, who was the last man out of the North Tower. He had come under tremendous pressure. He got went after his employer to get him to fire. His home was repeatedly searched. His phone was tapped. He was constantly harassed. Why? Because he talked about the explosions in the basement of the North Tower before the plane hit above. And then, of course, Jimmy Walters, multimillionaire, who put out some $8 million of his own money running ads in the New York Times and television stations in New York. And he actually convinced half of the people there in New York that, of course, they had not been told the truth. Totally blacked out across America. Of course, his life was threatened. They put a large boulder on the top of his car. His home was repeatedly searched, and he's living in hiding in Europe today. Ladies and gentlemen, this is what's happened to people who've actually put this out, tried to get the truth out. We do carry the DVD 9/11 Blueprint for Truth. That's 9/11 Blueprint for Truth. It is excellent. And you could show this to somebody who's a total skeptic, and they would understand. So give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And we hope that you'll get this, and you'll go ahead and get it shown as widely as you can. Remember, 3,000 or almost 3,000 Americans died that day, but the bodies of 1,100 of them have never been recovered, not even the smallest little fragment of bone. What happened to those bodies? Were they crushed when the building pancaked? Were they vaporized when the building exploded? And if you look and see those pictures of the beams, tremendous beams shooting out the sides of the building, you know, at 150 miles an hour and actually lodging in adjacent buildings, how would you get a beam to shoot out from the side of a building if there was a pancaking? Well, certainly we want to get some of the other information we have. We do have, of course, my pamphlets on Foreknowledge 911. There's a three pamphlet set, important. My pamphlet on 911, What Really Happened. We have the book Timeline for Terror. We think it's very, very important. That's Timeline for Terror. We actually have five DVDs, 911 Mysteries, one that was put out by Joyce Riley and her husband, and of course this gives it's called In Plain Sight. That's In Plain Sight. And then another one they put out called The Ripple Effect. And we have about five DVDs we carry. We think they're all important. I like 911 Mysteries. I especially like this one. We're talking about a Blueprint for Truth. So give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We have a four-tape set on 911 update. We have another four-tape or four CD sets. These are all available in CDs on Why Do the Buildings Come Down? There's 2 hours of interviews with William Rodriguez and 2 hours with a man who supervised the cleanup of the debris for building number 7. He says 99% chance that was a controlled demolition. He was there the day afterwards. So Why Do the Buildings Come Down? 911 update. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, that almost 1 million people have died over in Iraq because of what happened on that morning of September 11th, 2001. Don't you think you owe it to them to find out the truth? You can say, well, I don't believe it, and that's all right. You have a right, but at least look objectively at Building 7 come down, which is what I did, and that's what first convinced me that we had not been told the truth, because that was very obviously controlled demolition, and there's no way that Osama bin Laden could have got those explosives into the building. Not only that, of course, the Shanksville, where the plane crashed, Flight 93 crashed, there's no debris, there's no wreckage. And then if you look at the pictures of the Pentagon that morning, there's no wreckage of a plane. The wings disappeared, the tail disappeared. Where did it go? Well, we'll be back in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of one of our favorite guests, and that's William Greig. William, are you with us this evening?
I am. How are you doing, Dr. Stan?
I'm doing just fine. Appreciate so much your willingness to come on here. And what are we going to talk about this evening? Because there's so many things that are going on here in the United States and certainly over in Europe and in the Middle East and things that are taking place financially as the economic foundation of our nation is being systematically destroyed, as the government's lying to us about the rate of inflation. They're lying to us about whether we're in a recession or not. They're lying to us about the fact that the amount of debt and the deficits we have. And one of these days, the American people are going to wake up and find out that all the money that they've saved and put aside for their pensions, for their retirement, is simply worthless, like yesterday's sunset. Well, go ahead. What are we going to talk about today?
Well, we have to talk about the economy, obviously, and I think you've done a good job in setting the table here on a number of fronts that we have to pay attention to. But there's some other things happening in the world that have a direct impact on the economy for which the corrupt people who rule our country have no responsibility. If you take a look at what's going on in the Midwest right now with these horrible borderline apocalyptic floods in Iowa, where the Des Moines River has overleapt its bounds and appears to be doing Des Moines something akin to what happened to New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. At the same time, you have tornadoes and all other kinds of inclement and very disastrous weather that are plaguing the breadbasket of the United States. If you add that on top of what's going on with the destruction of the value of the dollar and the engineered dependence that we now have with respect to imports for foods, this fall and winter are going to be very, very rough. I mean, we see the elements of what could coalesce into something akin to a famine, not necessarily the sort that you see engineered in the history of the Soviet Union and China and Ethiopia and a number of other places, but in terms of acute shortages that contribute on the demand side to the radical increase in prices that we're going to have to pay. The demand side is going through the roof. At the same time, the value of the dollar is going through the floor, and no good can come from these two trends. And when you see that on top of what's happening in terms of the accelerating destruction of the investment bank sector and the unwinding of all of these really absurd instruments of debt that were the basis of the supposed prosperity the last 4 or 5 years, and the fact that a number of really keen observers, including the Shadow Statistics Guardian, Mr. John Williams, who actually tracks what the government doesn't want us to know about, the real cost of living, the real rate of inflation, the real rate of unemployment and so forth, these people are talking about September and October being potentially a catastrophic period for the great unraveling of the economy. And I think that that's something that has to be kept in mind, is that these two trend lines are going to converge with respect to the shortages that now are reflecting elements of the equation that are beyond man's control, coupled with the results of embedded corruption for many decades. This fall, this winter, may shape up to be apocalyptic.
Well, I certainly agree with you, and I share your concerns. And I'm really talking to people in the Middle West, why they're really worried that they're not going to be able to get the crops of corn and soybeans in. But even if they do get their corn in, why, a lot of it would be used for ethanol. And America produces about 60% of the corn that's shipped across international boundaries. We're the major source of corn throughout the world. And suddenly we may find that we're not going to have the corn to export that we traditionally have. But what's going to happen to the rest of the world? We'll be back in just a moment.
You know, I made reference earlier to the fact that we have an artificial type of interdependence with the world in terms of our trading policies. Now, I am, by inclination, a free trader in that I believe that it is to the advantage of everyone to have mutually beneficial exchanges of goods and services that, of course, benefit both parties by definition. Without government intervention, that's free trade, whether it takes place between people who live in the same community or whether it takes place between people who live on different parts of the planet. I generally tend to support that as a policy. What's being sold to us as free trade since about 1946 or 1947 is corporatist trade. It is regulated trade that benefits a certain cluster of agribusiness cartels and other people who are involved in sort of quasi-monopolistic capitalism where they benefit primarily by their political connections rather than sort of their productivity and by giving better goods or services in exchange for lower prices. That's the way the people, the latter way is the way the people should conduct their affairs. As Adam Smith pointed out centuries ago, that's not the way most businessmen want to conduct their affairs. They want to cartelize the economy. In order to do so, they have to work hand in mailed fist with the governing elites. And this managed trade system that we have now has created some really bad habits and really bad artificial expectations on the part of the consumers. I think it's a wonderful thing to be able to eat food such as strawberries and watermelon in the dead of winter. They're not seasonal, of course, in the dead of winter here in this part of the Western Hemisphere. But through the magic of this engineered trade, we can consume agricultural products from South America when they're coming into season at more or less the opposite time that they would be in season here in North America. The problem is that it makes no sense if you look at the economies of scale that the whole system would be set up that way. And so when there are disruptions here due to these elements of productivity, particularly in agriculture, over which we have no control, then things can really turn ugly in a hurry. You have bad wheat harvests overseas, or bad rice harvests, rather, overseas, and that can throw a crimp into the entire global network of providing rice from Asia to the United States, for instance. For instance, when we have bad rice harvests here, that has an impact on the way that people in countries such as the Philippines have to manage their own consumption. You have bad wheat harvests in Eastern Europe or Ukraine or some of the other places where they grow wheat, the same kind of thing happens because people have become forced into this unnatural system of interdependence. I believe that in most instances, if the free market were operating, people would be more seasonal, perhaps, in their food consumption.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, William is talking about how the artificial means we have now of free trade, supposedly free trade, is altering, of course, our pattern of fruit and vegetable consumption, how, of course, we're getting a lot of our foods from south of the border today, and so at one time we were the major food exporter. Now, of course, we're probably importing more food than in many respects than we're exporting, but what happens when we suddenly begin to see the whole world, of course, is covered by crops going from one country to another, but what happens when we begin to get a failure of crops, as we're seeing now in Australia because of the drought, as we're seeing in America because of the flooding, and as we're seeing in Africa and Asia because of rust on the wheat, and, of course, we're going to lose massive amounts of crops. At one time, we had a three-year supply of wheat here in the United States so that we could never be without. We have about a 40-day supply, ladies and gentlemen. And if anything happens to interrupt the wheat crop in America or another place in the world, we could well be facing famine. And we're not talking about some distant time in the future. We're talking the year 2008.
Yeah.
Go right ahead, William.
Yeah, we're talking about this fall and this winter, and this is the sort of thing that could rapidly feed on itself. It could create a real vicious cycle here in terms of the feedbacks that would occur in the global food markets. There's a wonderful writer by the name of Gregory McNamee who has written a book called Movable Feasts. He's somebody who's done a great deal of research on the economics of the food supply, and he's written a piece that was published in the June issue of Chronicles, which is a publication put up by the Rockford Institute in Rockford, Illinois. And this is how he summarizes our predicament. He says, these are bad times to be an eater in America, as anyone who has suffered a sticker shock at the supermarket can tell you. The cost of necessities, bread, milk, and eggs, has risen steadily in the last 2 years by as much as 30% in some parts of the country. vegetables, fruits, meats, cheeses, all of them are climbing. In part, the rise in food prices is a function of the cost of gasoline. Food travels a long way, 1,200 miles on average, to reach American stomachs. It does so because American manufacturers, giddy at the bounty wrought by the Green Revolution and the advent of jets and container ships, long ago taught American consumers to abandon the idea of seasonality. We have come to expect bananas, oranges, tomatoes, corn, and the like to be available year-round, requiring the transportation of strawberries from Chile, citrus from South Africa, tomatoes from Ecuador, hothouse lettuce from France, and so on and so forth. He's talking about the fact that food riots are now breaking out across the world in places like Haiti, Cameroon, Egypt, even places like Thailand, which generally don't see riots of any kind. And Thailand, of course, is a major rice producer, and it now limits how much rice an individual can buy, the better to sell the crop to an insatiable China. And that is a really good example of the perverse priorities of this trading system that is operated through the WTO to benefit people who are plugged into a system of global corporatism. It makes no sense at all that Thailand would be imposing food rations, you know, on their staple food, the main staple food being rice, and Thai rice is wonderful. It's one of our favorite staples here in the Grigg household, quite frankly. And in order to make sure that the politically connected corporations are able to sell to consumers in China, you have Thai consumers not being permitted by the government to buy rice to feed their own families. And that's a really good example of the type of dislocations that you see throughout the developing world that are part of the global trading system that has been imposed upon the world as now growth of the whole United Nations system. I mean, you go back and take a look at the fact that this is the handiwork of the same Alger Hiss who created the charter for the United Nations and served as the first Secretary General at the United Nations Organization Conference in 1945. It was Alger Hiss who created the rudiments of what was to be called the Global Trade Organization. It eventually, of course, was renamed GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, for many decades. And then in the mid-1990s, it was renamed the World Trade Organization. And they are in charge of determining the extent to which every nation as a nation is going to prosper through this globally managed trade. And, of course, one of the biggest elements of trade is what ends up on the tables of people across the world, not only here in the United States, but all throughout the world, whether you're talking about Europe or other parts of North America, South America, and Asia. And now we're in a position for the first time in the history of our country where we have to import a great deal, as a matter of fact, the majority of what we consume at the table. And so we find ourselves as a nation of some 300 million-odd people facing the vicissitudes of nature, you know, what those of us who are believers would consider to be, in some sense, a display of God's displeasure. I mean, that's something the Bible makes very clear. When the weather turns inhospitable, when famines and shortages of that sort begin to besiege a population, that's God clearing his throat and trying to get our attention. And so we find ourselves in a situation of that sort where, for the first time in our history, we're not self-sufficient in terms of producing the food that we consume, the basics, not the exotic things that would be Epicurean delights that we would occasionally indulge in, but the basic things. We import wheat into this country. That's something I found out about a year and a half ago when I wrote a cover story for the American Conservative magazine on the understandable concerns over tainted food products that were coming into this country from China. I don't know why we would import any edible products from China, but apparently we import quite a bit, not just the pet foods that were killing pets because of melamine contamination, but also all kinds of things are imported, and not only wholly produced finished food products, but components that go into food products in the same way that some components go into consumer electronics. A lot of the sausage casings, for instance, that you buy pre-cooked breakfast sausage, are made in China, and they're shipped here, and they're combined with American-grown pork, and they're called a made-in-America food product, but they're actually only partially made in America. But we're importing wheat into this country, and as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, for many, many decades, the United States was the breadbasket of the world. We produced much more wheat than we could consume here, and we exported it around the world at great benefit to wheat farmers in the Midwest and also great benefit to consumers on the other end of that transaction. But now we have to import wheat from Canada and elsewhere. And so we find ourselves playing in the same ballpark, if you will, as a lot of these consumers in countries like Thailand, the Philippines, and Cameroon and throughout the Arab world, where suddenly, because of the way the economy has been structured, these decisions are taken out of the hands of consumers, and they're taken out of the hands of local producers as well. And so, in a very real way, the fate of what we will find on our dinner tables is in the hands of people who are unelected and unaccountable, who have made themselves the masters of the global economy. And this is really going to get ugly, given the fact that the way the economy is going, we have a lot of shortages in our bank accounts just at the time the prices are going up. And really, if you take a look at all these elements coalescing, it does look like the proverbial perfect storm of really ugly things heading our way.
Well, I share your concern. I think that everybody should be concerned. Certainly, we've never even thought of the possibility of famine in other countries, and certainly not a famine here in the United States. But I will tell you, we work with people as ready-to-serve foods. You know, and of course, they have prepared dehydrated foods and packed in nitrogen. And basically, they're having difficulty getting rice supplies and wheat supplies and those things. Oh, they can get them now. It just takes a lot longer than they ever did before. But for the first time, we're beginning to see difficulty getting food, you know, for those people who are preparing it. And, of course, what is happening is people all across the country are beginning to realize this may very well be a very significant and real problem. And they want, of course, to begin looking after themselves, knowing full well that the government is going to look after the elite, but they've made no preparations, there are no supplies, there is no storehouse of wheat, 40 days or so at the most, and then, of course, you're on your own, ladies and gentlemen, you're on your own.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, once again, one of the major factors here is the meteoric increase in the expense involved in transporting these goods, not only across country here in the United States, everything that we consume of any consequence that has to go that average of 1,200 miles to get to the retail stores is trucked. Everything is shipped on trucks. You take a look at the price of diesel right now, and you understand that a lot of these independent contractors who are the truckers, these are people who have to pay their own fuel prices and pay their own taxes and fees. They have to maintain their own rigs. A lot of these people are finding their incomes plummeting, being cut by factors of 3 and 4 from what they made last year. They're going out of business. And that's something that is obviously being factored into the prices that we're paying in the supermarkets. And this once again reflects a number of factors. There's a deliberate effort, I believe, and I think this is something we talked about before, Dr. Stan, to create a speculative bubble in the fuel, the oil, petroleum futures market. A lot of the liquidity being produced by the Federal Reserve is being sluiced through investment houses into the petroleum futures market, driving up the price of petroleum. This is something that was discussed at the Bilderberger Conference a couple of years ago in Germany, the idea that the price that we were paying for oil even then was excessively low. And just since then, of course, if you take a look at the parabolic increase in the price of oil, it was around $27 or $28 a barrel as late as 2002 or 2003. It's crested near $140 a barrel just in the course of a few years. So a lot of it reflects price speculation, I believe, engineered with the help of inflation being created by the Federal Reserve. But you have to understand as well that that reflects the concomitant decline in the purchasing power of the dollar, which has hit bottom and started to dig. And if, heaven forbid, we end up in a shooting war with Iran, it's already been predicted that oil would easily surge over $200 a barrel. We'd probably see it above $250 a barrel, and that would thrust us literally into a depression of the sort we haven't seen since 1929. And in 1929, once again, we had the rudiments of self-sufficiency here. We were industrialized. We had excess capacity in industrial plants. Now we no longer have industrial plants to speak of. We had excess capacity in terms of arable farmland. And now, of course, we find ourselves importing food. We were a nation, however imperfectly, organized around families that reflected the appropriate model, that is to say, a mother and a father presiding over a largely autonomous household, often with the help of grandparents. That's a family model that has been engineered into near oblivion thanks to the social element of the elite's agenda to destroy our bourgeois society. And so we'd be heading into this type of a crisis with none of the advantages that we saw in 1929.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. All right. Wait a minute. Pick the story up there.
Yeah, we'd have none of the advantages if, heaven forbid, we end up with the 1929-style financial crisis that our society had back then. And we'd have a whole slate of liabilities, the likes of which our ancestors really couldn't have imagined. I don't think they would have imagined it possible that we would allow ourselves to be put into a position where we were importing food. They could understand us importing, once again, gourmet items. They could understand us importing gourmet cheeses, perhaps, from Scandinavia or France, or gourmet wines from France and Italy. They might understand some of the exotic things making their way across the seas, you know, beluga caviar from the Caspian Sea, or whatever luxury items would be on the plates of the aristocratic class. They could understand that. I think they couldn't wrap their minds around the idea that we'd be importing wheat. You know, I mean, that is something that has simply been the very spinal cord, if you will, of the American agricultural economy. And I think I've probably made it clear that I was astonished beyond comprehension a year and a half or so ago when I did the research for that article and came away understanding that since roughly, I think it was 2003 or 2004, we became a net importer of food and a net importer of wheat in particular. So we find ourselves once again definitely at the mercy of people who have engineered this system in order to benefit themselves. And as far as they're concerned, particularly the really hardcore environmentalists among them, as far as they're concerned, we're disposable. You know, great tracts of the human population are eminently disposable from the perspective of the people who are running this system. And I can't help but think that as things really turn ugly this fall, with huge increases in the price of food, huge increases in the price of energy, heating oil, and the corresponding social unrest that's likely to ensue, that we're going to start hearing and seeing some proposals, the likes of which would be and should be still shocking to our sensibilities, but would have been considered utterly inconceivable, say, 10 or 20 years ago. I mean, if you end up in a situation where food rationing becomes an official policy of the federal government, and it's become an unofficial policy for some food wholesalers right now, simply because of market necessity, simply because of shortages of product, if we find ourselves in a situation where we have overt food rationing in this country, things will go downhill from there very quickly.
Well, I agree with you totally, and I share your concern. I hate to always be a harbinger of doom, but we're trying to get our listeners out there to begin making preparations for what I believe are very difficult times. And if you don't want to believe me, get the Bible out and read the Revelation 6-8, and as we describe the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and then the rider of the pale horse, and of course we're talking about, you know, the fact that we looked and behold a pale horse, and the rider upon him is death, and Hades followed close behind, and power was given unto them to actually eliminate a quarter of the population of the world by war, by pestilence, by disease, and by famine, and by the beasts of the world. And people say, oh yeah, that's all well and good, but if you read the writings of people like Barbara Marx Hubbard, one of the wealthiest women in the world, who is deeply involved with the occult and the world Luciferian movement, she has actually had channeled to her a redescription of that phrase from the book of Revelation, and basically she tells you these people are going to have to be eliminated, and that's not your job, my dear, that is ours. For we, referring to herself and those who work with her, are the riders of the pale horse, death. They're going to bring it about. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is William Creek. We're talking really about the very real possibility of famine, certainly in certain parts of our population, but certainly throughout the rest of the world. As William has said, there are already food riots all over the world, but of course we don't see those on evening television. We hear about Britney Spears. We hear about, of course, the problem of the Lakers. My goodness, they don't win tonight. Why? Of course, the season's over for them. Won't it be a terrible thing if the Lakers, of course, are out of the finals? And all sorts of unimportant things. They busy our minds with unimportant things, and the very real problems will affect you and your children and generations unborn are totally ignored by the media because it's controlled. We do not get the truth. we very, very seldom emphasize and talk about the things that are going to impact on the American people, like the destruction of the American dollar through inflation and the famine and the coming war with Iran. And, of course, the nonsensical part of plunging us into a war with the entire Islamic world. And remember that they have nuclear weapons as well as we do. And, of course, what are the implications of that? Could we ever see the devastation in America that occurred, took place in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which was totally unnecessary because the Japanese have been trying to surrender and we wouldn't let them? Do you think God is never going to bring judgment on America? You go right ahead, William.
Well, that's the element of this whole scenario that people tend to forget, and that is that there is a creator, there is a sovereign God. That's something that was recognized by the men who founded our country, who wrote our founding documents. They understood that the rights that we exercise were endowments of our Creator, and that we created government to protect those rights. And they understood that there is such a thing as divine judgment. Even somebody who was so proudly skeptical of conventional Christian religion as Thomas Jefferson once said, "I tremble for my country, for I think I know that God is just." And, of course, judgment will come when certain things are persisted in defiance of God and God's law. And one of the things that I want to reiterate and italicize, underscore here, is the fact that when a civilization faces the prospect of severe calamity in the realm of harvests and weather, when you're seeing famine strike a society, when you see harvests not being brought in, when you see crops that are being relentlessly desiccated by heat, or when you see floods come and wipe out farmland and leave people unable to plant or harvest their crops, these things the Bible describes as divine judgment. These types of circumstances, floods and famines and tornadoes, dislocations through earthquakes and things of that nature, all these things that illustrate so vividly that man really, for all that we've accomplished, is really a puny and pathetic part of this whole system of things. We don't control all of the elements that compose this world that we occupy. You know, this world was made to be inhabited, Isaiah teaches us, but that doesn't mean that the inhabitants of this world control it. And when we see vivid reminders of that sort that imperil our ability to provide the necessities for ourselves, that's God's doing. He's calling us to repentance. I mean, this is a very important element of the entire discussion that very few people really want to recognize, because it involves recognizing that we've done things that are wrong, that we have persisted in things that are offensive to God, that we've been incorrigible, that is to say, we've not been correctable in doing things that are offensive to God, waging wars of aggression, institutionalizing torture, slaughtering the unborn, institutionalizing the oppression of the poor, attacking the family, desacralizing those things that are supposed to be sacred and worshiping those things that are ephemeral, trite, and useless. All these things are offensive to God. And after a certain point, we're taught in the Bible, God clears his throat. And when he does, he usually gets our attention by raising his voice in the form of these physical manifestations of his pleasure. So we have to attend to the spiritual things. We have to get ourselves right individually with God. And when we're looking at the political dimension of this, in the politics, of course, are defined. The political questions are defined by this spiritual warfare that you constantly tell us about, Dr. Stan. You know, this is a spiritual conflict between those who seek to understand God's will and do it, and those who believe themselves to be gods. You know, the Barbara Marx Hubbards of the world. The political element of what's going on right now, as you say, is so thoroughly swaddled in distractions that only when people are shaken and chastened are they willing to pay attention. And I'm desperately hoping that we've come to that point now.
Well, you know, I really have. I think we are. I think that more and more people know something's wrong. And I certainly talking to people all the time, my wife talking to people, suddenly they're beginning to ask questions. Why are these things happening? They don't quite make sense. And that's just why, of course, I do what I do, because I hope we're training people out across America so that they can begin to give the answers, ask questions, but give the answers. Explain to people what's really going on. Explain to them the media is controlled. Explain to them there really are people who would like to eliminate a large part of the people in America, a large part of the people in the world, because they have a different worldview, because they worship a different God. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's William Grigg, and you can ride ahead with your thoughts there, William.
When we talk about these people who partake of a worldview foreign to and inhospitable to the biblical tradition, we always have to talk about these little synods that they convene from time to time, the little clubs that they form, the cliques that assemble. And I'd made reference a few minutes ago to a Bilderberg conference that took place in 2005 in Germany, during which there was some discussion of the supposed need to bring about a radical increase in the price of petroleum. The Bilderberg group, of course, has been meeting since 1954. They've had 56 meetings of this group. It's a shadowy elite group composed on a two-thirds, one-thirds ratio of people respectively from Europe and North America. In some ways, it was a precursor of the Trilateral Commission that was created in 1973 by David Rockefeller, and culmination of a design spoken of in Zbigniew Brzezinski's book, Between Two Ages. You know, the Trilateral Commission draws from three areas of the world, as its name would imply, from Europe, Asia, and the North American hemisphere, North American continent, rather. And in recent years, the Trilateral Commission has started to bring in people from the Middle East as well, and also from South America, and they're trying to create this world that is organized into roughly 10, I mean, according to the Bible, it would be 10, different economic zones that would be governed regionally by affiliates of a global system that would operate through the World Trade Organization and ultimately through the UN or through some successor organization. But the Bilderberg Group, as I mentioned, was sort of a foreshadowing of the Trilateral Commission, and it operates today on sort of an ad hoc basis. They have these meetings every year, and they recently finished one in Chantilly, Virginia. And the really interesting thing about the most recent Bilderberg meeting, at least from my perspective here, was the fact that you had the chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, Mr. Bernanke, and you also had the chairman of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, Timothy Geithner. Both of them were there in, I believe, the capacity of presenting a shakedown version of a proposal that was made in separate speeches on Monday by Bernanke and Geithner, and also floated through the Financial Times newspaper, of making the Federal Reserve Bank the de facto, not just the de facto, but the de jure, the formal central bank of the world, and put it in charge of the investment banking system.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with William Grigg as we discuss what's really going on in finance. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's William Grigg. And certainly, as you know, he's formerly the senior editor of the New American Magazine, now, of course, works for the Wealth Society. You'll find his material at www.rightsourceonline.com. That's rightsourceonline.com. William, what will people get if they go to your website?
If they go to the Right Source, they'll find a number of news items and commentaries that have been selected by those of us who operate the website that we believe are useful in terms of finding out what's really happening in the world. We tend to dwell at great length on matters of individual liberty under siege by the fully operational police state we live under right now. It's a very mild version of a police state, but make no mistake, it is a police state. It's been militarized and federalized. We no longer really have a system based on local law enforcement. We basically have local affiliates of a centralized homeland security system, and we dwell a lot on that subject in the articles that we select for the Right Source. You'll also find at the top a banner ad for my new book, which is entitled Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. You can order that from the Right Source. You can order it from Radio Liberty. You can buy it at Amazon.com. It's about 300 pages long, and it's meant to be an overview, sort of a dissection of the police state, the homeland security state, a history. I give you a history of the affliction that led to this situation. I give you some really shocking examples of this homeland security apparatus in action. And then I also talk about some of the ways that hopefully we can step back from the precipice here and give back some of what has been taken from us. There are some hopeful things that have been happening. There was the rarest of things, a good Supreme Court decision yesterday on the issue of habeas corpus. It was a very incomplete, I'd call it a preliminary victory. in that it said that the Military Commissions Act was facially unconstitutional. Habeas corpus is a principle that has to be respected at all times and at all places where the government claims the authority to hold people, irrespective of whether they're citizens or not. But the problem with that Supreme Court decision yesterday, if I might just elaborate on that for a second, is that it assumes that something has to be done to modify our constitutional institutions to accommodate the apparently perpetual state of war that our society is now in. That's a very dangerous thing. Both sides, both the five judges who voted to strike down that element of the MCA and the four judges who voted to uphold the MCA in the dissenting opinion, both of them agree, both of these factions agree, that we're in a state of open-ended, perpetual, undeclared war against an unspecified enemy, and that our institutions are going to have to be brought into harmony with this new mission for the federal government. And I just don't see how you can assume those predicates without assuming, or rather accepting, the inevitable, which is that we're going to see institutionalized assaults on the Bill of Rights, what remains of our individual liberties protected by law. But that's something I discuss at great length. The attack on our individual liberties, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, habeas corpus, all these guarantees that are part of the Anglo-Saxon perspective of individual liberty protected by law that we inherited from the British system in my book, Liberty in Eclipse. And also, if you go to rightsourceonline.com, if you scroll down the page about a third of the way, look at the left-hand side of the screen, you'll find my photograph, and there will be a link that you can click on that will take you to my daily blog, which is called Pro Libertate. It's a daily blog in that I probably put something new on there every day, but between 3 and 5 times a week I will publish a new essay, a fully realized, fully documented essay on a subject of interest to me. This is not merely a stream of consciousness type daily weblog in the style of Larry King's USA Today column. He used to write what he called a three-dot column, which was just a series of non-sequitur observations on the passing scene. Most blogs operate that way. Mine doesn't operate that way. Mine is meant to be more of a chronicle, I guess you could say, an online cyber chronicle of the attacks on what remains of our constitutional system of protected liberties. And so if you go to the Right Source, rightsourceonline.com, you can have access to my blog, Pro Libertate. And I hope that as people read the blog particularly, that they will become angry in a useful way. That's the reaction I'm trying to provoke. I hope that people will read what I have to write, most of it by way of expose, and say to themselves, how dare they do this? You know, hopefully there's enough resilient capacity for outrage in the American public that people will still become offended over certain things that are very conspicuous displays of lawless corruption and the abuse of power, and at least protest what's being done to us. I'm happy to say that there was a lot of that kind of reaction to the child grab in Texas, which I wrote about compulsively for about 3 weeks. You know, these 460-some-odd people, including adults who were described as minors, were abducted from this religious commune in Texas on the pretext of a child protection operation. And this was done without any colorable pretense of law. It was a monumental display of corrupt, abusive arrogance on the part of the Child Protection Service bureaucracy in Texas. The worst incident of that sort since the Waco atrocity of 1993. And thankfully, I think largely as a result of the near unanimous public outcry by those who were paying attention. I mean, obviously, the people who are watching the NBA finals weren't interested. The people who are following every permutation in the sordid saga of Paris Hilton had other things on their mind. But there was enough of an outcry in the blogosphere, in letters to the editor, in talk radio forums, and in terms of direct phone calls from people to various policymakers, that you saw the CPS have to back off a little bit, and the state Supreme Court upheld the rights of the parents here in this situation. So, once again, every once in a while, you'll see that there is a tremor. There's a tremor of resistance here, and what I'm hoping is that through the outreach that we're conducting, the type of things that you do, Dr. Stan, through the outreach I'm conducting through the Internet, that we can provoke more and more of those tremors, and that fairly soon those tremors will metastasize into an earthquake.
Well, I really do believe that for the first time, people are getting concerned. More and more people are asking why. I think that probably the economic problem is accomplishing more than anything I could say or you could say. Suddenly it affects them. And maybe they're going to stop watching television. They're going to ask questions, and hopefully there'll be somebody out there who's read one of your essays, who's heard one of our programs, or programs are put forward by Alex Jones or by Joyce Riley or Jeff Rentz or the myriad of people out there now in alternative radio who are having an impact. This is the exciting thing. We are having an impact.
And I do think that you make a very salient point when you talk about the economics of our situation starting to take a toll on people's capacity for willful ignorance. Just a couple of days ago when I had to go fill up the van, we have five small children, we're a family of seven, we have to have a van. It's not the most economical way to get around right now, but if we're going to travel more than, say, 5 or 6 miles away from our home, we do need a van. Filling up the van, of course, costs something in excess of $110 now. And so I just don't let it get down below about a quarter of a tank. I just can't afford to. But when I was at the local Maverick station here, which charges usually 3 or 4 cents a gallon less than the competitors, and if you've got a membership card, you can get a better deal anyway beyond what they charge. As I was filling up my van, I looked across the pump at somebody else who was doing the same thing, and the look on his face was priceless. Just radiating, outraged disgust. And he looked up at me and he said, "They really don't care, do they?" And by they, I knew exactly whom he referred to. He said, "Yeah, they really don't care. You know, Bush and people of that sort really don't care about how did he put it? They really don't care about the way we live. They really don't care if we're going to be able to make a living. They don't care about how we're going to manage the affairs of our household." I'm paraphrasing now.
But I think, it's so vitally important that people understand that there really are those who do want to lower our living standards. For those who are skeptical, we suggest the Earth Charter, available up on the Internet, the Global Biodiversity Assessment Report that came out of the Second Earth Summit in 1992, where they talk about the necessity of lowering the living standards.
Yeah.
If we are allowed to live, why, of course, we're going to have 6 billion people, we're going to have to lower the living standards to that of the Eastern European. Of course, in 1992, that was the peasant, and that's what they really want. And the information is there. Anybody wants to document it, we'll be glad to provide you with the material if you can't find it on the Internet. People must understand, as they see, of course, that they're not able to buy the food, the gasoline, to travel as they want to, that this is not happening by accident.
Yeah.
There are people who have a different worldview who really want to lower our living standards, and when they realize that, I hope they're going to be about 300 million angry Americans. Go ahead.
Exactly. I mean, 300 million angry Americans who have their faces contorted into the same expression of coldly furious disgust that I saw radiating from this gentleman as he was filling up his SUV. The thing that I find interesting when you talk about those who would presume to dictate what our living standards would be, sometimes they can be very, very candid about it. You mentioned the Earth Charter. I, as I mentioned before, have interviewed both of the key authors, of two of the three key authors of that document, Mikhail Gorbachev and Stephen C. Rockefeller. I think Stephen C. Rockefeller passed away, didn't he, Dr. Stanley?
My understanding is he did, right.
Yeah. And I didn't interview Maurice Strong, who was the brains behind this primarily, and the deal maker who brought Rockefeller and Gorbachev together and put up a lot of money for it. But I have interviewed Gorbachev, and I have interviewed Stephen Rockefeller. And the document itself makes it very clear that, first of all, there's going to have to be a readjustment in our religious values. And of course, they have to start with the most important. They're at least honest about it. They're saying we're starting with the fundamental assessments, the fundamental principles and values that govern society. And you have to when Stephen C. Rockefeller made his presentation at the UN in 2000 at the Millennium Forum, he said something to the effect of, "We can't rewrite the Bible, but we can do is we can re-envision what the Bible says." And the first thing that has to happen, he said, is that man has to renegotiate his status in nature. And that goes right back to the book of Genesis. I mean, the book of Genesis, Adam and Eve were placed in the position of stewardship over God's creation. They were a separate creation from the rest of the orders of life. And there was said, these things you can, I'm paraphrasing once again the instructions that God gave to Adam and Eve. use these things, you know, wisely, prudently. They're yours to use. You know, the garden is yours to use. The animals are made for your benefit. You're a separate creation. You're at the apex here. You're different from these other orders of nature. What pagans of the sort that Gorbachev and Rockefeller represent would have us believe is that we're just part of a democratic biosphere. We're just another species. We're wildly out of proportion with the rest of the biosphere, and we have to be brought into a different relationship under the guidance of wise and far-seeing people like, you know, Gorbachev and Stephen C. Rockefeller and Marie Strong. Those are the people that are going to redefine our relationship with nature. Just in the next week or so, Time Magazine and ABC News are going to be calling forth this great synod of scientists who are going to try to tell us that unless we make these kinds of changes in the organization of our society and our patterns of consumption, humanity is not going to survive the 21st century. And, of course, they can say this in the serene confidence that none of these people will be around at the end of the 21st century to see if their predictions come true. But in the short term, this can be used to bring about at least a certain marginal acceptance of the idea that there has to be this centrally planned global economy that would be that would be imposed upon us by this council of elders that Gorbachev and his ilk would constitute for our supposed benefit.
Well, I think it's so important is the fact that people have to understand what they're really talking about is destroying the industrial capacity of
yes.
the United States in the name of controlling CO2 emissions and preventing global warming. With that will come the lowering of the living standards of the American people. What this whole global climate change bit is about is justifying lowering our living standards as we have no other alternative. But how many people are living in Phoenix want to live without air conditioning? How many people in Idaho are going to want to live without heat in the wintertime? And yet that's what they're really talking about. They don't want you to burn oil or coal or wood, you know, to heat your homes. They certainly don't want you to use electricity to cool your homes in the summertime. These people have an entirely different view because they believe we're using up their natural resources. We are using them up. Now, they're not going to give up their air conditioner.
Sure.
They're not going to give up their, you know, SUVs or their jet airplanes. But they really have a different attitude. They believe in elitist philosophy, an elitist group who will rule the rest of us, and this is exactly where we are headed today.
When I attended the 1994 Global Population Summit that the UN convened in Cairo, I was struck by a number of things, not the least of which was the flagitious hypocrisy of the people who were saying that we had to bring about a severe downward trend in human population growth in order to save the planet because of the excessive consumption primarily of the Western world. And also because if we were to permit the developing world to become capitalistic and free, that their patterns of consumption would be akin to those of the United States. So in order to bring about the supposed preservation of the earth, it would be necessary to prevent the emergence of other United States-style capitalist economies, or supposed capitalist economies throughout the developing world. And to do that, you have to put limits on how many children people can have, and reduce the growth rate of the human population. Now, you heard this at the same time these people were living in extraordinarily luxurious circumstances. You had these huge air-conditioned rooms that the people were holding these meetings in Cairo in August, okay? They brought in huge air conditioners for the purpose of keeping these people cool. They imported literally tons of beef from Europe so these people could dine on the fare that they were accustomed to. They had these people shuttled from meeting to meeting in air-conditioned limousines, and almost all of them flew private jets or diplomatic jets to go to this meeting to talk about the need for global austerity. And it's the same type of thing that happened with the recent World Food Organization conference to talk about the situation with world hunger that's emerging because the system that they've engineered is breaking down in terms of food distribution. They had a meeting a couple of years ago, and the public reaction to the publication of the menus that these people were dining on was so aversive that this year they decided that rather than having, say, half a dozen of high-end gourmet wines to choose from, gourmet and champagne selections to choose from, they'd only have two or three. They'd only have two or three imported Italian wines, and the Epicurean fare that was being served on the tables at these conference meetings was a little bit more modest. I mean, I looked at what they were eating. I said, good grief, you know, you could have, couldn't you have Denny's cater this or something? I mean, if you're going to be having a meeting about world food and world hunger in the middle of a crisis here where people are literally finding themselves unable to buy the necessities to feed their families, you should conduct yourselves with a little bit more humility if really you're sincere about the problems. But they're not. I mean, you know, no man is a hypocrite in his pleasures, we're told by Dr. Johnson. And, you know, no man is a hypocrite here in terms of the way that he manages his affairs when he's able to. This is the way these people are always going to live as long as they're permitted to. And at the same time, they keep telling us that our standards of living have to be engineered downward. I remember back in...
Oh, that's how William, we're going to just about out of time. Our guest has been, of course, William Grigg, and we're talking really here at Radio Liberty about the hypocrisy of these people who want to lower our living standards, and yet, of course, they are going to be living in luxury. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program. Hang on there, William.
Right.
Right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest, William Grigg, sort of reminds me of Prince Charles. You know, Prince Charles is a real environmentalist, and he often goes out, riding around on his bicycle to show that he is, he is really, of course, trying to conserve fuel. Of course, he has following him all of the Secret Service, and they're in their cars, you know, and his butlers in their cars. But he's out there riding his bicycle to show how he's willing to make sacrifices for the rest of us. Go right ahead.
Yeah, he's one of these photo op philanthropists.
Right.
But the thing that I find interesting, this is a crashing non sequitur, given what we were just talking about the most recent Bilderberg conference, you know, by way of talking about these elite groups that are planning our future for us, you know, how thoughtful of them to do that. There were a couple of people who attended that I think are worth noting. I mentioned, of course, the two people from the Federal Reserve who were talking about this new proposal to make the Federal Reserve basically the official piggy bank for the investment banking community. James Johnson, the former chairman of Fannie Mae, was a very conspicuous presence at the most recent Bilderberg Group meeting, and that's significant because he was the guy in charge of the vice presidential candidate selection process for Barack Obama. And also present was Kathleen Sebelius, who's the sitting governor of Kansas, a Democrat governor who's apparently at the top of the list of potential vice presidential picks for Barack Obama. We know that because suddenly there was this little boomlet in the media, apropos of nothing apparently, talking about Sebelius as the logical choice for Obama. And, of course, that boomlet is a direct result of the fact that she attended this conference where you had all the media gurus, the Wall Street Journal and Washington Post and Time Magazine and all these major retail outlets for the establishment propaganda matrix. They were there, and they saw these people together, and they put two and two together. Actually, they may have gotten specific instructions about this. But those are the kinds of things that happen as a result of these meetings. They were talking about raising the price of petroleum a couple of years ago. Now we see the price of petroleum has quadrupled over the last 4 or 5 years. They've been talking for many, many years about engineering downward the living standard of the West, particularly the United States, and now we're finding that the price of necessities is being placed beyond the reach of most households. You know, they plot war, they plot economic changes, they're talking about making radical changes with respect to the role of the Federal Reserve. These people presume to plan our future on our behalf. That's why we have to pay more attention to what they're doing, and we have to make their life miserable by exposing what they're doing to the public.
Amen to that. Well, our guest this evening has been William Grigg from RightSourceOnline.com. That's RightSourceOnline.com. William, thank you so very much for being with us, and we look forward to talking to you again next week as we explore the unfolding events that are going to have such a profound impact on the lives of everyone listening to this program. Good night. God bless.
God bless.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do hope you've enjoyed our talks with William Grigg, and of course he was just discussing the Bilderbergers, this secret organization. They met just last Monday. You're not going to read about it in Time Magazine, although the people from Time Magazine were there. They're not going to read about it in the Wall Street Journal, although the people from the Wall Street Journal attended, right along with, of course, Henry Kissinger and David Rockefeller and Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve System. Well, understand, ladies and gentlemen, we have elite groups groups that control us, not one but many, but they're all bound together by the same goal, the destruction of the sovereignty of America, the implementation of a new world religion. They want, of course, to impoverish our people here, and they want, of course, to have a world of ruling oligarchy who is, of course, them, and ultimately a world leader. Well, if you'd like more information and documentation of what we've been talking about, if you'd like to know about the plan to impoverish you and your family, you need to get our Sustainable Development syllabus. And for that, the talk, Sustainable Development, the Road to World Tyranny. And, of course, that the syllabus contains a summary of the Global Biodiversity Assessment and a copy of the Earth Charter. And you'll actually see exactly what they intend to do. They intend to impoverish you and destroy the value of your currency, to destroy the value of everything you've worked your entire life for. Let me suggest an excellent book. It's called Liberty in Eclipse. It's written by our guest this evening, William Grigg. That's Liberty in Eclipse. The Sustainable Development Syllabus, what we were just talking about, and of course the talk that goes with that on DVD, Sustainable Development, the Road to World Government. Let me suggest that you also certainly want to get the, if you want to understand what's happening with the weather and why it's so strange, why, of course, we have a book called Weather Warfare and another book called HAARP, the ultimate weapon of the conspiracy, because you see they can modify the weather today, and I think they're doing it. We have a 4-tape set on weather control. We have a DVD by Bob Fletcher on weather control. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, they can create storms and droughts. If you doubt that, of course, Zygmunt Bzezinski talks about that in his book Between Two Ages, published in 1970. You can buy a copy on the Internet, about $140, $150. They've collected them all. They don't want you to be able to get it, but we'll send you the pages if you request them. Between Two Ages by Zygmunt Bzezinski, who formed the Trilateral Commission, who's one of the leaders. In fact, he is the foreign policy advisor to Barack Obama. But this is a book he wrote back in 1970, talking about how we're going to be able to create storms and droughts and, yes, dreadful new diseases. Then, of course, we have a 4-tape set on weather control. We have a 4-tape set on HAARP, the High Altitude Auroral Research Project. We have a 4-tape set on chemtrails. You must understand that they know how to modify the weather, but why would they want to do that? Well, of course, you have to understand that there's some people who want to bring about the fulfillment of the biblical prophecies. With great famines and wars and pestilence, and of course they're working on new diseases, they've created new diseases. We have the diseases that never exist before, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, AIDS, Lyme disease, we have Morgellons disease, we have all sorts of new and strange, Ebola certainly was Marburg's disease. These are all new diseases and they all bear the marks of being created in laboratories. Now we have a great new DVD by Dr. Garth Nicholson, one of the world's leading scientists. It's called Terrible New Diseases. It's a talk he gave here with, of course, a slide presentation. Very well done. We're very happy with it. Terrible New Diseases. And if you know people with chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia or Lyme disease or so many of the other diseases, even there's an element of this in autism, why, of course, you need to get this new DVD, Terrible New Diseases. And, of course, again, the material on weather warfare, that's the book, or HAARP, the ultimate weapon of the conspiracy. The 4-tape set or the DVD on that subject of weather modification, the 4-tape set on HAARP, on chemtrails, and then, of course, the book by William Grigg, Liberty in Eclipse. You need to understand what's going on. And then number 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is under attack today.
you're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.